Hello and welcome to another Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast. Luke Taylor here, and we're in person with one of my favorite people in the wine industry and probably the world. We're not going to talk about Browns football because that could be painful, but don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review.
It was a good season.
It was a good season.
Nobody expected that.
No one expected that. But don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and also, too, if you love us, if you like us, and you want to support us, join our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/CorkandTaylor. We got Larry O'Brien, trusted agent, trusted friend. We probably could have just recorded the podcast for the last 20 to 23 minutes we were talking about random stuff. So, Larry,
State
welcome.
State of the Wine Union is what we were discussing.
Yes, yes.
Good to be here, sir.
Yes. Good to be here. I don't know where we go. I guess we can talk about, I mean, I love these trends. You know, every year there's a new trend. You know, it's amazing to me that, you know, that's kind of the trend, I guess. But so I took January off, took a couple other months off because of dry January and no one's drinking wine, including myself. But February 1st, first episode. And Larry, so where do you want to go?
Well, professor, in preparation for this class,
yes,
I stayed up late last night studying. And the study was the very recently released 2024 Silicon Valley Bank State of the Wine Industry Report. I believe that thing's now in its 30th year. And when you say Silicon Valley Bank, obviously there are some other things to discuss. But Steve McMillan, who is the wine industry guru extraordinaire, for the last several decades has been publishing a State of the Wine Industry report. And I thought, what the hell, there's probably no better time to discuss what's going on in our trade. It might get a little wonky. It might get a little nerdy. We're not talking about grapes and places and aromas and flavors and textures, but it's a fascinating time to be in our trade, as we were just discussing momentarily.
Yeah. Yeah, is it really? It's tough. I mean, it's been challenging. I mean, I know from a distributor standpoint, we were down. I was trying to think. I talked to one of the bigger players in Ohio, and I think they were down by a couple percent. But it'll be interesting to see. And I think there's a lot that attributes to it. I think there's just way too much, too many wines. There's not enough, I guess, shelf space or wine list space. I mean, it's getting more competitive again. That's the big problem. I think the younger generation has just too many options. I don't think they're drinking. I don't think people are generally drinking as much. I know one of the things we talked about on one of the reports was that volume is going to go down, but price point is going to go up. So
that's happening as we speak. You hit on arguably the single most influential factor in the decline of wine consumption in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's a generational shift occurring. That's huge. And the younger generations are seemingly less interested in wine. Why is fascinating. And they're distracted by other recreational narcotic opportunities. I mean, just think back a few years to White Claw, that as a brand is still powerful, but it's lost some of its market share, yep. I'm sure, to High Noon and the spirits-based things. And, oh, by the way, there's some cannabis out there that's becoming much more accepted. There's also the spirits issue and bourbon, which seemingly never peaks, but the rise in interest in tequila and mezcal and rum. I feel a little bit of momentum for cognac, interestingly enough. It's just sort of an abstract perception rather than something I see in front of me. But clearly, anecdotally, you can point to successes for tequila in particular. There's just a lot of distractions. And to your point about consumption, and there's no better time to talk about a decline in consumption than dry January. And there is a very serious problem facing wine as part of alcohol. Wine was able to separate itself as the healthy alternative within beer and spirits and wine. Wine was the beverage alcohol of moderation. Wine was the beverage alcohol of sophistication. Wine was in some way healthy. Today, wine is losing its perception of being a healthful alternative to other beverage alcohols. This has been going on in Europe for about 15 to 20 years now. Alcohol, a drink is a drink is a drink, and there's a massive decline in consumption throughout Europe in nations that are traditionally steeped in wine history, wine culture, wine legacy. And it's one of the most serious problems facing the wine trade. We have to figure out a way to convince a younger generation of American wine consumers that wine is a healthful alternative, that drinking wine moderately is better than drinking spirits not moderately or drinking beer not moderately. In that Silicon Valley Bank report, more people think cannabis is healthy than think wine consumption and alcohol consumption is healthy.
Right.
That's a problem.
Yeah. You can spin it any way you which want to, right? I mean, let's be honest. And it's interesting because, it's just people are drinking less. But what I found was interesting, you said this just before I press record, was that a glass of wine is more expensive at a restaurant than a cocktail, correct? Mm-hmm. I think you said,
yes.
and a glass of beer.
That I didn't make that up, ladies and gentlemen. That was, in fact, quoted by Steve McMillan via Nielsen IQ. Yeah, Nielsen, those people who tell you who's watching what on TV, they do a lot more statistical analysis for many, many other industries. And the quote was direct. It was, a glass of wine nationally in a restaurant is now more expensive than a cocktail or a beer. And that brings us to the fact that, yes.
But here's the thing. Wine, if you open for a couple days, is going to spoil.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably one of the bigger factors, correct?
Yeah, but you would think that would create a reason to want to sell wine more rapidly than beer or spirits, which are not perishable. Beer's moderately perishable.
Right.
Spirits are not.
Right.
Wine is much more greatly perishable. You would think the restaurateur would want to sell it a little more quickly and therefore have some margin considerations. But we've experienced the trials and tribulations of inflation in wine industry like any other industry. Our costs have gone up. And in 2022, and more particularly in 2023, you saw across the board increases in price in our trade. Wine got more expensive. As wine gets more expensive, the restaurateur has made no allowance for the increase in price. They still want to operate on the same pre-COVID principles that are no longer really applicable. And I'm probably going to piss off a lot of restaurateurs, but I'd love to get into the nitty-gritty with them about
right, this. But here's the thing, okay? Their food costs went up.
Yeah.
They raised their dish and their food, right? Their wine costs went up. You know what they did? They traded for something lower. I had this conversation with a winery, and it still befuddles me. He said, you need to raise your prices. I said, okay, so I'm going to raise my prices. And that $8.66 Pinot Grigio that you buy, which he doesn't, but I'm just saying in general, is now going up to $9.99. You're not going to buy it. You're going to find something for $8.66 or cheaper because there's always another option. Is it better? No, but it's cheaper. And I think a lot of people are getting very lazy, and I'm going to piss people off, which I do every day. I'm called asshole 6 times a day at least. We're not at 1 yet. We're not even at noon. But the point of the matter is people that are selling wine on the restaurant side are getting lazy with it to a certain extent.
I don't know. I don't know if I can say lazy, but I will agree that as the wine that you were used to selling, the wine you were comfortable selling, the brand that you wanted and your guests wanted, and I'm speaking as a restaurateur at this point, you as a restaurateur are comfortable with a brand. Your guests are comfortable with that brand. The price of that brand went up, and you default to the next less expensive option. Well, what happens as you default to less expensive at this particular moment in time? You are getting into more and more marginal fruit sourcing from marginal land, and the quality of that product is going to get more lowest common denominator, more ordinary. And the I find so many restaurateurs rationalizing, this is just as good and it's less expensive. I apologize. It's not as good.
You know what we need to do is we need to get a case of Welch's grape juice and put in a bottle of wine. I mean, because that's what it comes down to. I don't mean to be nasty and mean, but there is some bad wine out there.
And the process that's occurring on the production side of our trade is very obvious. As there's less wine consumption, as the guest, as the client, as the wine consumer has traded up over the last 25 years, the wine consumer has traded up. The lower price point at retail, sub, let's call it $11.99, sub $11.99, actually sub $9.99 would be more accurate, sub $9.99. Sales are slowing.
Well, there's nothing there now.
There isn't, and the price point that's increasing more rapidly is what they reference as the premium, and more specifically the ultra premium and luxury price points. And in short, ladies and gentlemen, in the world of retail wine statistics, ultra premium and luxury, let's call that $16.99 and above.
I'm thinking you're going to say like above 50.
No. When it comes to retail, $16.99 would be ultra premium. Anything
seriously?
Above, anything above, say $22.99 to $24.99 would be luxury.
Really?
And we're talking about high volume retail.
Right.
We're not
right.
talking about going into
the wine shop or the wine boutique or the wine bar that sells you and stuff like that.
Correct. So. The statistics are black and white and irrefutable. Inexpensive wine sales are declining rapidly. Premium, ultra-premium luxury sales continue to increase. However, there are less people consuming. It's a demographic shift. Boomers, I'm a young boomer. Boomers can only carry so much weight
right.
as they depart the mortal coil,
right.
as they leave the planet, then the onus is on
the next generation.
Yeah.
X
is a tiny cohort, and while they love their wine, and they love their good bourbon, and they love a craft beer.
And they love their seltzers
Actually, X does like it all. Yeah. X is a relatively small cohort. It's not a large group, and I kind of consider myself more X than boomer. Meanwhile, millennials that are now approaching their late 30s, coming into their early 40s, coming into their prime earning, you know, we're hopeful that like every generation before it, that they begin to resemble their parents, that they begin to assume the same likes and dislikes as their parents, even though they pushed away for a good 25 or so years. But as Mr. McMillan points out, hope ain't a strategy. You can't just wait for the next generation to become their parents. You have to have an active outreach to them. And to date, we haven't quite been able to figure out
right.
the millennial generation. And God forbid we start talking about Gen Z, or as it's called within the trade, LDAs. As people become of legal drinking age, LDA, the options are plentiful. There is this concept of generational distanciation. They don't want to do what their parents or their grandparents did. And we are having a hell of a time trying to figure out how to reach them and make wine accessible to them so that they're drinking wine on a regular basis and making it a part of their lifestyle. And it's unfortunately a challenge that we haven't been able to master
right.
at this point.
TikTok. No, but here's the problem, okay?
Right. You know, the sad truth is,
yeah.
you're right, but as a 59-year-old dude, born and raised in the Rust Belt, corn-fed white boy, as I like to call myself, like I have no use for TikTok.
Well, we could do some mighty things with you in a bottle on TikTok. Or Twitch or whatever the other one and only and all that. Dude, we can blow your sales up. But here's the problem, okay? You hit the nail. You kind of hit the nail on the head. And I've had this conversation now, I feel like, off and on for 3 years. I talked to the guys at Mira in Napa, Bear, and also Gustavo. And it's interesting because I talked about what I'm going to be doing on top of my wine distributorship in the near future. But there's so many options, okay? There's so many wines, okay? What is Jackson Family Wines, who you're employed by? Yep. And then also we'll talk about my end with all these small boutique premium wines. How do they make it? How do they grow sales? How do they, and I know you said, you know, you haven't figured out the legal drinking age people and maybe even the millennials. What do you guys do differently than you did before, let's say, COVID? Because I feel like COVID has really reared its angry head. It's kind of thrown this industry for a loop, per se.
Well, McMillan hit on this in his report. It's in the first few slides. And in the first few slides in this report, McMillan is talking about Darwin and the evolution of the species. And it isn't survival of the fittest. It's survival of the most adaptable. I'll give you one thing that Kendall Jackson, most particularly the founding brand of Jackson Family Wines, we're also La Crema and we're also Freemark Abbey. It's a big, broad portfolio. But the founding pieces of the portfolio, Kendall Jackson and La Crema, are constantly searching for relevance. And in order to remain relevant, you have to be adaptable. And one of the adaptions that we've made recently with Kendall Jackson is the low-calorie wine category. I get it, but it is a multi-billion-dollar global phenomena. Low-cal, low-alc, no-alc. We've got mocktail bars that are relevant in certain markets, and they're relevant not to a 59-year-old Rust Belt kid.
Right.
They're relevant to 26-year-olds in Manhattan or Chicago or San Francisco
Seattle. But you know, once they start having kids, there better be damn alcohol in that wine. Let's be honest.
Well, again, it's will these generations, Z and the millennial generation, begin to look at wine as the healthful alternative? Well, I don't know, because I don't know that we've told that story of health. I don't know that we're telling the story about wine's historical significance to the culture of man. Nobody's talking about wine as being with man since the very beginning. We don't have a Robert Mondavi at the moment.
I mean, Jesus drank wine.
Yeah, he sure did. It was the first miracle he performed at the wedding of Cana. Yeah. Think about the people who made wine culturally significant in the latter part of the 20th century. It was Robert Mondavi. Yeah. There was a great story with the Judgment of Paris that caught everybody's attention. These upstart American wines were as good, possibly better than these stuffy, staid French wines. We need a Steven Spurrier. We need a Robert Mondavi. We need a French paradox. The French paradox in 1991, oh my God, that seems like ancient history, 1991. How did America become a wine-drinking nation? Well, there isn't one answer. There are multiple factors influencing our movement to becoming a wine-drinking nation. And the French paradox was a huge part of that. For those that aren't aware, there was a 60 Minutes segment on how the French eat all this fatty food. They throw some foie gras on a piece of crusty bread, and they eat all this fatty stuff, and yet their lifestyle and their lifespan is better than ours because, oh, it's the wine that's doing it. Well, truthfully, it wasn't the wine. It was more their genetic pool. But wine played a little bit of a role in their healthful lifestyle, even considering cheese and foie gras and fat and all the other things that they loved. We don't have anything like that right now. We've sat on our hands as a wine trade and not and we haven't continued to promote wine as a healthy, moderate beverage alcohol.
I feel like we did in the early 90s. And that was
of
it.
Of course
right.
we
and
did.
That was it.
There was a guy named Gene Ford. I remember very clearly, G-E-N-E-F-O-R-D. Gene's been gone quite some time. But a good friend of mine, fellow master sommelier Matt Satriglia, introduced me to Gene Ford's moderation reader. Gene was not a doctor. I think Gene was a lawyer, if I remember right. But he published a regular newsletter that brought to the world all the positive scientific research on the healthful benefits of wine consumption, and eventually it was alcohol consumption. Moderate alcohol consumption in conjunction with a healthy lifestyle, diet, exercise, moderate wine consumption, moderate alcohol consumption was at worst ineffectual and at best positive for the people that are participating in a healthy lifestyle. We've just done nothing to compete with that. How is it possible that Gen Z and millennials think that cannabis is more healthy than alcohol consumption?
Because the cannabis industry has done a good job to promote and educate that clientele, age group, what have you.
In the face of a lot of research that's coming out now, it says, no, regular consumption of cannabis is not healthful in the long term. It used to be, good Lord, don't allow a developing 10, 12, 14-year-old's brain to be regularly influenced by cannabis and its effects. That's extremely detrimental. However, an adult brain has much less fear. Now I'm hearing, oh, no. There's fear for adults that are regularly consuming cannabis, and they aren't a part of a healthy lifestyle. And look, I know a lot of cannabis partakers. I have good friends that are cannabis partakers. But I think it's how it's consumed and who's consuming it. Liars, damn liars, statisticians. I think everybody should make a choice on their recreational narcotic. I think it's extremely detrimental that wine has lost its place as the civilized, moderate, healthful alternative in your
You know who I'm going to have on the podcast in 2 weeks is Nancy Reagan. She was wasn't she big on say no to drugs?
Yeah, well, she was. Like, I was
also
which
dead.
Nancy
yeah.
Reagan? You mean, that Nancy
First
Reagan.
Lady.
Actually, Nancy Reagan helped Kendall Jackson get its launch. She took a shine to it and put it on a state dinner around 1983 or 1984, and that was hugely influential.
Yeah.
So, yes, Nancy Reagan was just say no. You are absolutely correct. We need Nancy to say just say no to cannabis and just say yes to wine. But, again, that celebrity piece or that credible endorsement is sort of what we're lacking these days. Again, there's so many issues. Let's talk about FOMO. Again, as a 59-year-old, dude that doesn't watch too much TikTok or understand modern acronyms, the FOMO acronym, I'll admit it, I had to look it up. Had to look up FOMO.
What is FOMO?
Fear of missing out. And you know what the wine industry doesn't do real well?
Yeah.
Create that fear of missing out urgency. You know who does a really good job with FOMO? Bourbon.
Yeah.
Look at those guys.
Oh, my God. Yeah, my next-door neighbor.
Diamonds.
I know. It's crazy. You know what? I think the wine industry has never adapted. I mean, obviously, we're talking about this.
At least really slowly.
Or really
glacially.
Slow. Right. I think it's always kind of like, you're in a – it's exclusive. They try to promote exclusivity and high-end and luxury and stuff like that. But, that's not for everybody. And I think a lot of wineries that I deal with, how are you going to adapt? Is it instead of maybe making 10,000 cases a year, make 6 and become more profitable? I know of wineries.
That is really an interesting discussion.
Right.
What you're getting into are the X's and O's and the financial aspects.
But also, too, like if you make 30 wines, don't make 30 wines. Because here's what I love is, we make 25 wines. Well, how big's your wine club? You make more wines to satisfy a wine club. You don't make more wines for the distributor, because I don't want to carry 25 wines. You know, the most I'll ever carry from one winery, if they have two separate lines, is maybe 10 or 12, because then you start confusing people. And then it becomes an inventory issue, and then a warehouse issue, and then a reps, like, you know, it's just...
What is the brand's bandwidth for SKUs that are relevant to the consuming public? And, you know, the more important the brand, the greater that relevance. But then often brands will overstretch their, miss their mark. They have to have a raison d'etre. They have to have an identity with the consumer. And it's very rare that a brand can be all things to all people. Think about a car brand. Does Cadillac make SUVs? Well, yeah, they do, but they don't make pickup trucks. They might have even tried at one point. There might have been an Escalade pickup, but I don't think that's what they're doing these days. They get back to what's core. What is their core mission?
You can't be everything to everybody. And I think the problem is these wineries will go to market like, oh, you should make a white blend, or you should make this, or you should have this, or, you know, it's like, everybody should have a Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay from Napa.
It's funny you say white wine. I read this. I was trying to find the source. I read it clearly. It was in my head. I don't remember where I read it. It was on Wine Business, and I tried to find the link.
It was on Instagram. I know. Come on.
It was not on Instagram. I have an account. I wouldn't even know how to get on it. White wine is trending as a more desirable choice for these younger generations than red.
Hence why, who bought Rombauer?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot.
Was it Constellation or Gallo? It was Gallo.
I thought
it was Gallo.
Yes, Gallo.
It was Gallo.
Yes.
Which,
yes,
was weird, because Gallo usually buys brands, not property. And it's because I read a report somewhere that said that white wine consumption has increased. It's like 1%. But they're preparing for that.
Well, what's the best-selling wine by grape variety in this country?
Sauvignon Blanc. Chardonnay still. See, but it seems like, but if you think about, like, in my sphere, I feel like we sell more Sauvignon Blanc than Chardonnay. That's why I said that. But I understand that.
You are correct. The trend for Sauvignon Blanc amongst white wines is the fastest-growing trend. That's correct. But Chardonnay is the best-selling wine by grape variety, and its trend is diminishing. I think it was like it's receding, but it's still such a well-built category with such a great foundation. It would be hard for any two white varieties to or three, for that matter, to combine to create the same volume of cases, millions of cases. So here's a little trivia question. How large is the U.S. wine market by dollar volume? How large is the U.S. wine market by dollar volume?
By dollar volume? Meaning like how many billions?
Yes. See, you're in the right category. I know. You got the right number of zeros.
I would say... $100 billion?
$70 billion.
Okay. So we round up. I'm Canadian. We round up. So it's I'm right.
Yeah.
$70 billion.
$70 billion. So how large is the U.S. wine market by case volume? How many cases of wine are sold? These are 22 figures, by the way. Professor, I did do some studying last night.
$70 billion, I would say, okay, and I got to do my math here. I would say... $10
billion? 310 million cases of wine are sold.
Yeah, that's a horrible guess. 10 billion's off.
Yeah, you had to do the math in your head, and I can't.
Yeah, it's too many zeros. I mean, I usually could get it, but that's just too many zeros.
Ladies and gentlemen, the United States is the largest consumer of wine in the world as a nation. Our problem is, in fact, our per capita consumption is declining regarding wine. Per capita consumption of alcohol, broadly speaking, is declining. Yep. Misery loves company.
Which I thought was funny, because I heard someone was telling me, or read somewhere, what have you. They said every alcoholic category was down last year. That's-
again, please go on the McMillan report and get there. But yes, it's not down. It's our rate of growth has slowed. Meanwhile, the spirits category, the beer category, the cannabis category are very active in courting a new generation of consumers. The wine industry, according to McMillan, and it's pretty obvious, you just look around, we are staid. We don't seek new innovative ways of reaching a new audience. We tend to not spend a lot of money on television ads or print ad. We're not making tear jerking commercials that you saw around the holidays for Chevrolet. We're sort of old school mid 20th century stuck in our ways, and I think as a result we are losing market share in an incredibly competitive environment for these other alternatives to your recreational narcotic.
And it's not just like commercials, like on a national standpoint, but on a local standpoint, what are wineries in their tasting rooms, their wineries doing to attract? They're thinking, well, we'll do this $150 6-course wine dinner. Okay, that's not what about doing like, what about putting a beach, like put a beach volley, have a beach volleyball league? And do something like that, or do like a bocce. I know a winery that has a bocce cart. Do a bocce league. Get like 20-year-olds and, you know, sponsor sports teams like, you know, the single softball leagues and stuff like that. You've got to hook them in. And I mean, the problem is there's so much. If you look at Instagram, you know, the reels, I mean, I get caught looking at it and laughing. It's just quick, 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 quick.
That does something to my brain. I don't know about you, but when I find myself scrolling, I swear it does something negative to my ability to focus, and in some ways it mentally wears me out. I've literally stopped doing it. I can't say I've stopped doing it, because bring a trailer, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a car nerd, you will get addicted, but that I do find myself scrolling on Bring a Trailer. I just think it's bad for you. But again, the whole social media thing is clearly. You asked me a question that I really didn't answer. How has Kendall Jackson adapted as a brand? We've attacked social media in the last 10 years in ways that I don't think we could have ever imagined. I don't know that Jess Jackson could have ever imagined the importance of social media and all of its many platforms. I mentioned to you prior to coming into the room that a good friend of mine imports grower champagnes. Social media influencers' importance to her are incredible. She benefits immensely from social media. Because her scale is small, but because these influencers have such incredible importance and influence, to be redundant, it's a major important factor for her in reaching her target audience without having to spend.
What kind of numbers does she need? I might be available for a very cheap price. No, but it is important. So you've got to think of non-traditional ways, which are traditional nowadays, to not brainwash, to hook, to promote, to create visibility.
Well, I am going to reference a concept that is as old as the hills in any consumer good marketing, and that is human interaction. Wine consumers, irrespective of their age or their cohort, Z, millennial, X, boomer, they want experience. In a post-COVID world where we were isolated from one another, we didn't have experiences. We had virtual experiences. What happened in the wake of COVID? People had revenge vacations, revenge travel. There was revenge part two. In the wake of COVID, it's very evident to me anecdotally, I cannot speak on a statistical basis with scientific studies and numbers being crunched. Anecdotally, I can tell you people are more attuned to in-person experiences than they've ever been. We must meet the wine consumer in their own environment. 2 days before Thanksgiving, not Christmas, it was Thanksgiving, I poured at a Giant Eagle in Westlake. And there's nothing more powerful than meeting the wine consumer in that environment. I don't, and I think when you meet the wine consumer in that environment, we've got to have somebody who really understands what they're telling the consumer. There's nothing worse than misinformation being relayed, but you learn from them, they learn from you, you have an ability to influence their purchase. I was at an event in Hilton Head this last weekend. I had 64 people in a room. The demographic was largely X and Boomer. As a matter of fact, if I think about it, there were probably no millennials in the room. That's a problem. Yeah. However, it does tell you that the Gen X and Boomer generation want experience. This was not a wine dinner. This was a chef cook-off. I had in four corners of a large private event space in a really nice place, Sea Pines Resort on Hilton Head. Yep. We had each chef create a small composed bite. It wasn't a little teeny thing that was a couple ounces. It was a bite, possibly 4 to 6 ounces between protein and starch and vegetable. And with each table where the chef was preparing this small bite in four corners of the room, there were two wines. And there was a little bubbly on the reception. And it wasn't a seated, served, coursed dinner. It was social. It was no hard start, no hard stop. We rolled into it. We rolled out of it. And guests had a great time. This is our fourth time we've done it. And we've sold it out every time. Consumers want experience. They don't necessarily...
You need different experiences, yes, though. Not your sit-down, all right, let's talk about the food and the
195
wine.
plus.
Right.
Correct. They want substantive experience.
What did that one cost? Do you remember?
The truth is I don't remember. I want to say it's less than 100.
So like $75 to $100.
Somewhere in that general vicinity.
Which is for two people, husband and wife, it is 2024, a couple, whatever, husband and husband, whatever it is. I don't really care, but you do you. But it's $150 a night plus tip and tax. It might be $180. They have a good night. They have a good time. It's relaxed. It's fun. There's a good electric. Or you go to a wine dinner, and it's $150 or $125 plus.
Per
person. And it comes at $300. And then it's like, oof.
And so, then there's no money left in their pocket to purchase wine
exactly.
at the end of the
and
night.
And if you're not selling wine as a distributor, salesperson, or a winery, you're not making money. Okay, let's be honest. So
the idea of a wine dinner as a promotional event is not particularly effective. The idea of a wine experience as a sales event is really where we should be. But then we need the cooperation of that restaurant that's holding this event.
Or country club or whatever.
They
right.
can't sell the wine at their full list markup. And God forbid we get into a discussion of restaurant markup of beverage alcohol.
I had a country club once that was trying to sell it as a restaurant thing. So they might buy it for me from $30 and they wanted to sell it for $100 or $120. I'm like, dude, it should be $50. And because here's the thing is, and I think some people don't, there's a small percentage of people just don't understand that. Would you rather sell it that night? You have no overhead. You have no carrying costs. You have no, you don't have to store it. You've already sold it. So get rid of it.
I was at Mary's Vine in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Ladies and gentlemen, listening to the podcast, if you ever find yourself in Pittsburgh, go check out Mary's Vine.
We got Jack and his lovely bride, yeah?
It's in Rankin. It's in an old church, really cool setting. The young gentleman whose family owns Mary's Vine said that very thing. He literally said, I'm going to sell it for whatever it takes to be sold tonight. The margin is important. Of course it's important. But the cash flow is more important.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Would you rather get 30% that night than not get it ever?
Correct. And put it into your storage right. and have to count it yep. and have slower cash flow. It, again, this whole issue is I've never owned a restaurant. And I'm at disadvantage. I'm at a disadvantage when having a conversation because I don't have skin in the game. I don't truly understand the financial covenants of operating a restaurant. But I do understand that 70%, nearly 70% of wine sales in the United States is what?
Retail.
Direct to consumer and wine club.
Yep.
70%, nearly 70%. Yep. That means, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, that people are buying wine as they visit California. Yep. They sign up for a wine club, and or they're buying directly, not without being involved in the wine club. Yep. They're simply going online and buying their favorite wine and having it shipped. Yep. By the way, here's another little trivia question: what is the average price of a direct to consumer Napa Valley bottle of wine? This is a good. You should be good at this one.
The average from Napa?
Yeah.
The average price?
Bottle of wine direct to consumer.
$60.
Guess again. Can 40, I get 70?
70
here, 70 here, 70
more?
Here. Oh, 80 here, 80 here, here.
100?
80. No, not quite. $84. The average price of a Napa Valley wine being sold direct to consumer is $84. So ladies and gentlemen in the audience.
And you know what the great thing is? When they sell it to consumers, you know how much they make? 100%.
Yeah, in other words, when you go online, ladies and gents in the audience, when you go online and you go to a California winery.
Don't do it.
Don't.
Unless you're outside of the state of Ohio.
Yeah. The price you're paying is normally about the same price as Ohio retail. In other words, to Luke's point, the winery gets to make all that profit rather than having to share that profit with the three tiers of distribution, with their wholesaler and with the retailer or restaurateur. When you buy direct from the winery, they're profiting greatly. When you buy locally, they're not profiting as much. But the price you see advertised by wineries directly is often the same exact price as the Ohio price. It's a high retail. Other states don't have state minimum pricing. As a result, they're a little more competitive. But
you're killing my business, Larry. Killing your business.
I don't think we are killing business because there's something called the convenience factor.
Yeah, absolutely. And for a lot
shipping ain't cheap.
No. Plus with weather and time and, you know,
there's about 3 days a year you can ship a case of wine safely.
Yeah, it seems like, especially if you buy, like, Bordeaux futures.
You're going to bake
it or freeze it. Yeah, well, especially if you order Bordeaux futures, which I have in the past. It's like, all right, here's our four-hour shipping window. But, no, I mean, it begs a question, and it begs the answer, is people on our side of the business have to be smarter, better planning, better ideas, more in front, creative.
You're taking the words right off the page. Flexibility, adaptability, nimbleness, innovation. These are all the words that are used in Macmillan's report.
And if you don't, your numbers are going to go down. It's just plain and simple. There's too much competition. There's and we've told about this. So I'm starting a consulting side of Cork & Taylor on top of my distributor business because I've been in the wholesale management. I've been in PR. I've been in marketing. I've been in television. Got the podcast. It's done very well. Is a lot of wineries, or not a lot, some wineries just don't understand and get it.
Well,
to a certain extent.
Yeah. It because there are a lot of people that bring their brilliance, the capital that results from their brilliance – to the wine trade. It's this generational thing that happens in Napa more so than other places, but certainly in many other places. But in Napa, every year, there's this little bit of transition, this little bit of succession. 25 years ago, a 45 to 55-year-old person who was very successful in their endeavor, a husband, a wife, a woman, a man,
whatever,
doesn't matter, they buy a winery.
Yeah.
And 25 years later, that winery is being sold because of a lack of succession planning. Their children, should they have any, aren't interested in operating a winery given the challenges.
Yep.
or they don't have a plan to move forward, or they've just decided that it's too damn hard to make a living selling wine. You and I, prior to coming in, both hit upon the concept that making great wine is much easier than successfully selling and running a successful business in the wine trade. And it's the absolute truth. It's a cliche, it's a stereotype, but it is born of reality. There's an enormous amount of great wine that never sees the light of day because
there's no story, there's no execution, there's no planning, there's no boots in the ground. There's just nothing, right? And I see it and I hear it. I think, and just because you're good in one industry, like I might be good in this industry, but I'm not going to open a medical company. I mean, it's just like, you know, or I'm not going to become a surgeon.
God forbid.
Yeah. Hey, I'd have my father-in-law and brother-in-law's on speed dial as orthopedics. But you know what I'm saying. But it's just like, the thing is, and this is what's going to happen, and it kind of maybe needs a shuffle because, you know, wine is sexy and hot and it's, you know, and it's, you make all this money and it's luxurious and all this stuff. Yeah, look at us right now nodding our heads like, who do you think we're kidding?
You just asked me if I'd want to own a restaurant. No, for those very same, it's so sexy to own a restaurant. Yeah, well, try it before you buy it. Rent before you buy, people. Get into it and see what it's like. We were talking about the human resource element as we walked into the room. And that human resource element, the challenges regarding human resources are hard for everybody. It just seems that it's harder for restaurants and harder for our side of the sales trade. Everybody thinks selling wine is romantic and we're tasting wine all the time. You know those silly memes, this is what people think I do, this is what I think I do, this is the reality. This is a really challenging business that is uber competitive, and the same is true of the restaurant business. And we just don't have enough people willing to give this a try vocationally. Give the restaurant business a try vocationally. Here's a little bit of good news. Here's something really cool. The African American interest in wine is growing by leaps and bounds, and I see it everywhere I go.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's very heartening. You know,
refreshing,
some of the things we're talking about is disheartening. It's very heartening to see a new demographic find wine of interest. And I love the fact that there are some celebrities that are leading that.
Yep. A lot of NBA basketball players. Yeah. And I think it's good. And they're doing, because I've seen some stuff on social media, some different events and some fun events, and that they're bringing refreshing ideas. And I think the majority of the wine industry needs to look at that and almost copycat. Because, you know, they're getting the younger generation. They're getting the 20s and 30 years old because it's cool and it's, you know, it's fun. And that's what wine is. It's not.
And I don't know that I'm the guy to execute on that stuff. I think I have to stay with my cohort.
Right, right.
And we'll let the younger generation influence their peers.
Right.
The problem is we need more people of that generation and more diverse people to come into the trade. It is this.
But I think it's gotten better, the diversity part of it.
It has, but what comes first, the chicken or the egg? You know, the cart or
the
horse?
Well, don't even start that because, you know.
We want diversity, and we recruit for diversity, but there has to be a will on the part of these diverse demographics to come into our business. And it ain't easy. Yeah. It's not like you say, would you like to buy some wine? Oh, yes, I'd like to buy some wine. It's not quite that simple.
Here is my credit card. Get me whatever you'd like. You know, no, you're right. I mean, that's the thing.
You have to be pretty resilient. You have to have a pretty thick skin. You have to get comfortable hearing no.
Just be married for 20 years.
Yeah. And in the world of wine sales, no doesn't mean no. No means just ask the next question to try to get to the right answer.
Or no means not now, but maybe later. Right. Now, if you get three no's, then you need to shut the hell up, right?
At that moment.
At that moment.
Yes.
But I think that's the thing. I think, you know, if you're still passionate about the industry, you've got to get aggressive. You don't have to be, you know, annoying or obnoxious, but you have to be aggressive and find that passion. Because here's the thing. With the economy going the way it is and all this competition, is what stands out? If you're some wine on the shelf, why should I pick this wine over that wine, right?
And more often than not, somebody's recommendation is what makes the difference in the consumer grabbing that wine. Right. If it's just on the shelf, I don't know, you're playing a game of chance. Yeah. If you're doing your job, there's somebody recommending the wine. It could be the wine steward on the aisle in the retail environment. It could be the server in the restaurant. It could be that I did an event, there were people at the event, I influenced that person, and that person told their neighbor, hey, I just had this wine. Influencing the influencer is what's incredibly important. And in order to influence that influencer, you've got to have credibility. You've got to have passion. You've got to have knowledge. These are all the things I coach. I coached a bunch of kids at Sea Pines Saturday afternoon about how to sell and how to be more confident and sincere about wine. And you don't need to be an expert. You don't need to be a master sommelier to be an effective salesperson when it comes to wine tableside. You simply have to have some confidence and sincerity, which means you have to invest a little bit of time.
Well, you should also
in learning
taste the
your
wine
craft.
Yeah,
that's exactly what
all,
we did.
It's all about the glass, right? And that's the thing, because I find like, oh, would you like this? I like this red, and that's it. But I think to go back to some of these wineries is, I think a lot of it's time management. You know, the smaller wineries are trying to do everything. You know what I mean? They don't have that thing, but invest restaurant, invest the time, whether it's a winery, just invest the time, even if it's just an hour a week, you know, make some phone calls, put something on Instagram, you know, train some staff, try some different stuff, go to, you know, network and stuff like that. I think COVID has made us these like hermits almost. And it's like, oh, we can do everything but from our phone. But there's still this element of the face-to-face interaction, right. You know? Because here's my thing. My opinion of Kendall Jackson before and what it is now is completely different because of you.
And it's because I've brought relevant information to you. That information wasn't known.
Right.
That we have this place in the retail environment, and there's others that are on either side of us at the same price. In that place, we share space, we share price, but that doesn't mean we're the same. And just telling that story, our biggest boss at Jackson Family says it all the time. We are storytellers. That's our job. Now, it's a little more complicated than that, but ultimately, a huge part of what we do when we sell is tell stories, differentiate. There is the storytelling piece, that's the wine knowledge piece. There is business expertise, and there is sales expertise. We call that the triangle of success.
Right.
And it's a brilliant theory. And for those that are interested in the wine trade, I'd love you to remember that. A lot of people think it's all about wine knowledge, and it really isn't. Sales skill is massive, and business acumen is massive. And you ascend in our trade when you put all three of those things together, and you're ascending, you're growing your skill and ability within that triangle of success. Wine knowledge, sales skills, business acumen.
I think that's enough, Larry.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's enough. So, Larry, as always, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Or shaking hands here. Fantastic. And hope you had that was a really fun and exciting interview episode, as always, with Larry O'Brien. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And we'll be back in a couple weeks on the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast. Keep drinking the good stuff.
Amen.
And drink more of it, too.
Please. The capita consumption needs to go up.
Yes. Now.
Moderately.
Do it now.